Les colloques du Collège de France.
Bonjour à toutes et à tous, nous reprenons nos travaux. Bienvenue donc pour cette deuxième journée du colloque Boulez, l'invention au pouvoir, les années 1975-95. Ce matin, la session donc s'intitule La musique en question, et il s'agit de s'interroger finalement sur la structuration intellectuelle, idéologique, mais aussi logistique et institutionnelle de la pensée de Boulez et du tournant, ou en tout cas de la façon dont il essaie de concrétiser à partir du milieu des années 70 un certain nombre d'idées directrices sur ce que doit devenir la musique, son langage, ses techniques. Donc la matinée, elle est divisée plus ou moins en deux parties, en deux moitiés en fait. On va en quelque sorte attaquer Boulez de l'extérieur, Boulez from the outside, avec deux communications qui ne sont pas boulezologiques en tant que telles, mais qui viennent saisir la place de Boulez et son rôle dans des organisations ou dans des modes de pensée plus larges. Et puis une deuxième moitié qui serait plutôt inside Boulez, ou close to Boulez, et qui serait donc autour de la collaboration et des modes de travail de Boulez à l'IRCAM, puis de la, disons, la poétique boulezienne dans les années 80. Donc j'ai le plaisir d'introduire Eric Droth, qui est professeur de théorie musicale à l'Université du Texas à Austin, et qui est un spécialiste de musique contemporaine et notamment, on pourrait dire, d'histoire culturelle de la vie musicale française. Il a fait un livre sur ce qu'il a appelé la Elusive Revolution de la musique française post-68, et donc sur la façon dont différents groupes ou cultures musicales se sont emparés des idéaux et des questions de mai 68. Et donc c'est ce qui m'a donné l'idée et l'envie de l'inviter à se pencher sur le cas de Boulez depuis son propre chantier de recherche. Donc un grand merci Eric pour ta venue.
Merci beaucoup. And to begin, I want to just thank Pierre, Michel, and Nicolas for the invitation and apologize for presenting in English, but my French is atrophied in the past few years, and I think it would be more clear for me to speak in English. Also, I want to thank them for inviting me, even though je ne suis pas boulezologue, because as at least one person in this audience knows, I have been thinking about this paper for almost 20 years now, ever since I started doing research on French cultural politics in the 60s and 70s. And so it's really a delight and a pleasure and an honor to be able to finally have an opportunity to share this research with you all. Moi, je suis léniniste à 300%. How are we to evaluate this exclamation made by Boulez, made in the course of a 1966 interview with the critic Martine Cadieux, along with his roughly contemporaneous pronouncement made in Der Spiegel that blowing up opera houses would be the most elegant solution to their cultural obsolescence? This avowal of Boulez's commitment to a certain brand of artistic revolution has often been treated as a provocation. This, for instance, is how Dominique Jamus appears to interpret the claim, which he quotes not once but twice in his 1984 biography of Boulez. Oh, okay, sorry. Mes excuses. While Jamus argues the Boulez of the late 1960s wouldn't have minded a revolution, he immediately tempers this assertion by noting that Boulez was nonetheless a realist, having ceased to believe in revolution a long time ago, end quote. Coupled with professions made elsewhere by Boulez, that where he declares himself to be no political revolutionary, lacking the aptitude or technique for it, we are left with the impression that Boulez's declaration is meant to scandalize more than anything else. By this interpretation, his comment partakes of a longer rhetorical tradition within artistic modernism, one that can be traced back to the shock tactics that Peter Berger identifies with the historical avant-garde, or going back further still, the drive among the decadents in the late 19th century to épater les bourgeois. At this point, one might expect me to contest this interpretation, particularly given the title of my talk. On the contrary, I actually find this way of reading Boulez's declaration and other similar remarks he made over the years to be broadly correct. Yet correct isn't the same as adequate. A provocation, this statement may be, but it's also more than that. As I'll argue in my paper today, even if Boulez's remark isn't to be taken literally, it should be taken seriously, since it offers insight into important aspects of Boulez's thinking during a transitional moment in his career. In particular, it sheds light on how he imagined systemic change in the world of contemporary music, both at an institutional and aesthetic level. And just as importantly, it sheds light on what he imagined to be the most effective way to usher in the sorts of transformations he deemed necessary. There are a few reasons why it would behoove us to attend to Boulez's self-professed Leninism more closely. First, far from being an isolated declaration, references to Lenin and Leninism were a recurrent theme in Boulez's writings, lectures, and interviews from the mid-1960s to the mid-1970s. I'll trace the development of this theme in more detail shortly, but for now, suffice it to say that in addition to advocating for a particular model of institutional transformation, the trope offered a suggestive way of both envisioning the musical field and symbolically valorizing his position within it. Second, a good part of what made such provocations provocative was the context in which they were uttered. That a musician like Boulez would feel obliged to announce his leftist bona fides was perhaps to be expected at this particular moment in time. But given the tumult within the French left in the years leading up to and after the events of May 68, to declare oneself a Leninist was to stake out a very specific and very contentious political position, which in turn carried over via homology into a no less specific and contentious position within the field of cultural production. While various political factions on the left fought over their claim to be Lenin's true heirs, from the Parti Communiste to various Trotskyist and Maoist factions, Leninism was most closely associated in the public imagination in the 1960s and 70s with the first of these, with the PCF. And Boulez's tacit alignment with the position that the PCF occupied within the political field, though not necessarily with the party's actual politics and policies, it needs to be emphasized, was further strengthened through his affiliation with the Tel-Quel group, which infamously threw in with the PCF during May 68, denouncing the student worker movement for its adventurism. While Boulez's signature didn't adorn the more incendiary of the two manifestos the group issued during the May uprising, he did sign on to their declaration, La Révolution ici maintenant, which denounced engaged discourse for its complicity with, quote, the obscurantism of the bourgeois state, a criticism whose obvious target was Jean-Paul Sartre, but that extended just as well to the May movement's celebration of ostensibly unmediated political expression. So in the rest of my paper, I want to trace the evolution of this Leninist theme in Boulez's public utterances. I'll begin by discussing some of the variants of it in the years between 1963 and 1974, so in the run-up to the period of this conference, that's the focus of this conference, and that's the period leading up to two key moments of institutional consecration for Boulez, the founding of EURCOM and his nomination to the Collège de France. Key to my argument is that Boulez's repeated appeals to Leninist models of revolutionary change shed some light on how he conceived of EURCOM and its musico-political mission, at the same time as it helped to symbolically fortify his position within the field of contemporary music. In other words, this prise de position sought to preempt potential critiques of his collaboration with the musical and political establishment, most notably the center-right government of Georges Pompidou, as well as forestall what Pierre Bourdieu has dubbed the process of artistic aging, a problem that all artists confront, but that's particularly acute for a committed modernist like Boulez. Finally, I'll consider some of the contradictions embedded in Boulez's Leninist theory of systemic institutional change. To be clear, these aren't contradictions that pertain to his actual political beliefs, which isn't really a concern in my paper. Whether Boulez was or thought himself to be on the left, right, or center isn't at issue here. Rather, the contradictions stem from his attempt to transpose a model of systemic change to a non-systemic level, as Boulez endeavored to overhaul certain institutions and practices of musical life without at the same time overhauling the political economic system within which they are embedded. It The earliest reference to Lenin that I found in Boulez's public statements came in the course of his essay, Le Goût et la Fonction, one of his 1961 Darmstadt lectures published in Tel Quel in 1963. After wrestling for a number of pages with the dialectic between the rational and the irrational in composition, represented by function and taste respectively, at the end of the essay, Boulez tips the balance between the two poles decisively in favor of function. Elaborating on his claim earlier in the essay that, quote, tous les bouleversements qui sont survenus dans l'histoire d'un art sont nés d'un changement ou d'un changement de sens des fonctions, he contrasts such real or substantive disruption with the more superficial revolutions that only occur at the level of taste or style. Quote, Satie employait les machines à écrire dans son orchestre, Weber ne les employait pas. Les surréalistes vociféraient au carrefour, Joyce se renfermait chez lui et se berçait de vieilles chansons irlandaises ou d'airs d'opéra italien. Quelle est la plus grande provocation? To clarify why Weber and Joyce succeeded where Satie and the Surrealist failed, Boulez invokes one of Lenin's more famous maxims. Quote, Lénine, qui a changé de tout au tout le style et le goût des révolutions, disait, le communisme, c'est les soviets plus l'électricité. Je reprendrai volontiers cette opinion autorisée quant à la révolution du goût. Il se produit souvent des explosions d'anarchie, les bienvenues soient-elles. Mais sans l'électricité, c'est-à-dire sans l'organisation de l'économie esthétique et de la sociologie des formes, tout se détériore rapidement. Without dismissing revolutions of taste entirely, indeed, the whole essay can be understood as an effort to rehabilitate the importance of taste. Key for Boulez is to subject such impulses to an organizational logic, anchoring them in a more durable form. The second reference to Lenin comes in the course of the interview with Martin Cadieux that I cited earlier. Published in Les Lettres Françaises, a literary journal affiliated with the Parti Communiste, Boulez's comments develop and transform many of the themes discussed in Le Goût et la Fonction. Here, his targets aren't historical figures like Satie or the Surrealists, but contemporary experimental musicians. Unfortunately, we don't have a kind of Rosetta Stone like Jonathan discovered in his later writings, but it's pretty clear, most likely, that Boulez has in mind here Cage and post-Cagean composers. As before, a core criticism is the absence of an organizing framework, necessary if experiments, musical or otherwise, are to have lasting significance. Quote, faire une expérience ne veut pas dire mêler divers ingrédients par curiosité et voir ce qu'il en sort. Une expérience doit contrôler une hypothèse de travail, la vérifier. And as before, a contrast is drawn between a serious Leninist model of revolution and mere anarchism, as embodied in experimental music. On a eu peur d'une cécité musicale conservatrice qui existait et au lieu de la faire sauter de l'intérieur, on a entouré ce noyau de non-professionnels pour l'attaquer de l'extérieur. Alors là, moi, je suis léniniste à 300%. Ce n'est pas avec un groupe d'anarchistes qu'on fait les révolutions. Il faut plutôt tenter de hausser le monde musical, de faire éclater la situation par le dedans. To be noted here is how revolutionary transformation is articulated with professionalism. Without the requisite expertise, any attempt to change the system is destined to fail. The next example I wish to cite doesn't reference Lenin or Leninism directly, but does so obliquely through the invocation of its others or rivals. In a talk given in Saint-Étienne on 13th of May 1968, later published as Où en est-on, Boulez surveys the contemporary musical field and its relation to the general public. Time doesn't permit a full recounting of Boulez's wide-ranging reflections. For present purposes, what needs to be emphasized is his disquiet concerning the fragmentation that contemporary music had undergone following the constitution of what he called a solid and reliable language in the immediate post-war period. Even though a return to the idiosyncrasies of aesthetics and taste was, as we've seen, both inevitable and to some extent desirable, the problem for Boulez was that this tendency had gone too far, with too many artists retreating into their own private ghettos. His term, not mine. He elaborates, quote, Il se forme donc de petits groupes autour d'une personne ou d'un groupe, chacun défend son coin et se regarde comme le mode est à la mode, comme un groupuscule. I've noted in my book how Boulez's use of the term groupuscule while the May events were still unfolding was a loaded gesture, all the more so given the negative inflection with which he imbues it. In a context where the principal political opposition on the left pitted Maoist and Trotskyist groupuscules against the Leninist old left of the Parti Communiste, to side against the former was to invite an association with the latter. Motivating this disdain for both political and artistic groupuscules was the partial and limited response they offered to what, for Boulez, were general problems. Hence he notes that while, quote, on peut toujours satisfaire un petit noyau de personnes, what's important for him is, again to quote, de faire progresser l'expression musicale jusqu'au point où elle devient un moyen de communication générale. Coupled with his arguments in favor of a wholesale reconfiguration of orchestras, the architecture of concert halls, and the need to address a broad public, all issues broached in Où en est-on, partial solutions appeared inadequate in the face of the systemic problems facing musical life. The antagonisms that remain veiled, albeit thinly, in Boulez's Saint-Étienne discourse are spelled out more clearly in the fourth and final example I wish to highlight. In an interview with the critic Jacques Longchamp, published in Le Monde in 1974, shortly before the press conference that would publicly launch IRCOM, Boulez again decries the stagnation of contemporary music. Part of the problem is that basic research has fallen by the wayside, hence the need for a center like IRCOM, which will enable such research to be conducted in both a collective and systematic manner. Here as elsewhere, Boulez cites the Bauhaus as a model for such interdisciplinary collaboration. On découvre enfin en musique l'importance d'un travail de groupe comme celui du Bauhaus. Set against this positive example of musical reform is a negative one, this time embodied in the post-68 fashion for free improvisation. For Boulez, those who place their hopes in improvisation and spontaneity recall the futile gestures of the far left. Au fond, ça ressemble au gauchiste en politique. On pourrait croire que des gens intelligents qui veulent faire la révolution doivent s'attacher d'abord à analyser la société qu'ils veulent combattre, comme Lénine. Pas du tout. Ils pensent que la révolution, ça se fait en hurlant devant les cris d'ailleurs fermés de Renault. Reaching back 6 years to the ill-fated effort by student militants on the 17th of May, 1968, this isn't just a made-up example, this has actually happened, you know, and he remembered it 6 years later. So the ill-fated effort by student militants on the 17th of May, 1968, to join forces with striking auto workers at the Renault plant in Boulogne-Billancourt. Boulez reads the gesture as manifesting a kind of repetition compulsion, one that recalls the marketing tactics of the very society that student worker militants were contesting. Quote, ils sont le reflet de la société de consommation qui croit que parce qu'on annonce un produit 15 ou 20 fois de suite, ça va finir par agir. For this reason, both gauchistes and partisans of free improvisation are, in his estimation, false prophets of revolution. They are, in fact, les plus réactionnaires, car ils entrent dans le jeu de cette société et en deviennent de simples soupapes de sécurité. It's around the time of the Longchamp interview that Boulez's references to Lenin and Leninism begin to wane in his public statements, though there may be other instances I just haven't come across. It's tempting to think that the founding of IRCOM and the Ensemble Intercontemporain obviate the need for such rhetoric, since he was now in a position to effect the kind of institutional reform that he could only advocate for in the past. And it's also worth knowing that by the mid-1970s, right, the sort of political climate was changing, and so references to Lenin probably lost some of their edge. In any event, some themes can be drawn out of this roughly decade-long trend in Boulez's public utterances. As Jonathan Goldman and others have pointed out, including Professor Nattier and his contribution yesterday, a continuity in Boulez's thought is its reliance on binary oppositions. His Leninist reflections on cultural politics were no exception to this rule. Three oppositions in particular stand out: spontaneity versus organization, amateurism versus professionalism, and partial versus global or totalizing perspectives. I'll say a few words about each of these in turn. Regarding the spontaneity-organization dialectic, Boulez unsurprisingly takes the side of organization. By contrast, the changing cast of characters occupies the side of spontaneity over the years, reflecting the changing fortunes of different currents in the world of contemporary music. Thus, the Keynesian experimentalism that's critiqued in the mid-1960s gives way to free improvisation by the 1970s. What makes the Leninist framing apposite in this instance is the way it recalls a core opposition in Lenin's theory of revolution. One of the main arguments leveled in Que faire, what is to be done, concerns the insufficiency of spontaneous working class consciousness, which according to Lenin invariably dead ends in trade unionist demands for improved wages and working conditions instead of pushing for the abolition of capitalist social relations. Further heightening the salience of the spontaneity versus organization binary were debates following the sudden emergence and equally sudden collapse of the May 68 movement. If for critics of the student worker movement, its failure underlined the limits of spontaneous revolt, for the movement's supporters, the simple fact that the revolt had occurred at all, despite the foot-dragging of the PCF, spoke strongly in favor of spontaneity. And I cannot emphasize how much there were essays about the spontaneity organization dichotomy within political journals in the wake of 68. They were just everywhere. As for the second opposition, Beleza's elevation of professionalism over amateurism was premised on the belief that any profound transformation must be grounded in expert knowledge of the domain to be transformed. This too echoes a core aspect of Leninist thought. Discounting the revolutionary potential of spontaneous worker action, Lenin insisted instead on the need for quote-unquote professional revolutionaries to provide direction and coherence to mass movements. Quote, no revolutionary movement, Lenin argued, can endure without a stable organization of leaders maintaining continuity, adding that such an organization must consist chiefly of people professionally engaged in revolutionary activity, end quote. An important corollary of this stress on professionalism is a recognition of its limited jurisdiction. Competence is specific, restricted to a particular field of action, and not transferable to other fields. Hence, for all his invocations of Lenin's theory of revolution, Boulez was nonetheless very careful to disclaim any expertise in political affairs. As he remarked in a 1970 interview in L'Express, quote, les gouvernements ont peur des révolutionnaires actifs parce que ceux-ci sont capables de prendre leur place. Ils n'ont pas peur des artistes. Il faut choisir. Ne pouvant être militant, je me méfie des attitudes politiques. The third opposition active in Boulez's references to Lenin contrasts local or partial perspectives with systemic or totalizing ones. Some part of Boulez's advocacy for a systemic approach to the problems of contemporary music culture, of course, had to do with the breadth of his own professional activities, engaged variously as composer, conductor, concert organizer, critic, arts administrator, among other things. Another part had to do with the systemic character of the very problems he sought to address. Notable here are his comments on the economic difficulties facing orchestras and other ensembles in his Saint-Étienne talk, something I'll return to at the end of my paper. But as we've seen in relation to the same discourse, his position was informed by a sense of disappointment as the unity of purpose of the early post-war period dissolved over the course of the 1960s into a more factionalized landscape. Again, Boulez could find rhetorical support for his embrace of a global or systemic perspective in Lenin's political theory, as for instance in the latter's support for a centralized party organ that would be in a position to, quote, shed light on the whole of our political life, something that Lenin believed to be beyond the limited capacities of local political formations. Along similar lines, the artistic groupuscules that Boulez castigated were, in his estimation, incapable of instituting true or lasting change. And this was because their limited, partial vantage point prevented them from recognizing what needed to be changed in the first place. So far, I've emphasized the way in which Boulez's repeated references to Leninism lent weight to various arguments he made about the then current state of contemporary music, the need to transform it, and the most effective way of doing so. In many cases, the appeal to Lenin serves to bind together various oppositions, structuring his thought, telescoping them into a single master signifier. In addition to this work of condensation, references to Leninism also tip the balance of these oppositions in favor of one of the terms over the other. Organization over spontaneity, professionalism over amateurism, totality over the local. Furthermore, these oppositions aren't mere abstractions. Rather, they are mapped onto various agents who occupy distinct positions within the contemporary musical field. In this sense, the repeated citations of Lenin and Leninism were more than an appeal to an external authority, but presupposed, in addition, an isomorphism between the politics of contemporary music and politics as such. In Bourdieuian terms, Boulez establishes a homology between the two domains as a way of buttressing his position vis-a-vis rivals in the struggle for symbolic valorization. Extending this Bourdieuian framing further, it's easy to see how the struggle Boulez waged was less against any particular figure or current in contemporary music than the specter of artistic aging that he confronted at this particular point in his career. This is most evident in Où en est-on, where Boulez repeatedly returns to questions of generation. Indeed, the talk begins with Boulez noting that he is part of a cohort qui n'est plus jeune, while the fragmentation that troubles him is associated with a younger generation. Quote, cette grande unité dont on avait pu rêver il y a 20 ans s'est révélée un mythe, un leurre. And this is because, quote, une nouvelle génération se tourne de tous les côtés, et les plus jeunes particulièrement. Making this generational turnover all the more problematic is the primacy that the upside-down economy of the arts grants to the new, and by extension to youth. As Bourdieu notes, quote, the preeminence given to youth by the field of cultural production comes down to the spurning of power and of the economy that is at its root, end quote. That is to say, the disavowal of visible signs of material or worldly success means that newcomers have a built-in advantage since they haven't had the opportunity yet to accrue much capital, cultural, institutional, or otherwise. I might cite Pierre Michel's work where he talks about how the sort of loser-takes-all logic which he describes, you know, by that standard, newer generations always have an edge over their elders. The upshot, as Bourdieu notes, is that the aging of authors, quote, the aging of authors, works, or schools is something quite different from a mechanical sliding into the past. It's engendered in the fight between those who've already left their mark and are trying to endure, and those who cannot make their own marks without consigning to the past those who have an interest in stopping time and eternalizing the present state, end quote. Viewed in this light, the utility of Boulez's Leninism becomes apparent. At a time when his biological aging was being redoubled and reinforced by a process of artistic aging, a process that his growing institutional recognition only aggravated, to draw a homology with Leninism was to thread a very, very tight needle. It was to place himself on the side of revolution, renewal, and rejuvenation, as was to be expected of any modernist in good standing. But it was to lay claim at the same time the right to define what counts as a true musical revolution and what is merely a passing fashion. To the extent that his appeal to Lenin proved persuasive, Boulez stood to benefit twice over. Through the legitimation that stemmed from adopting a revolutionary position within the world of artistic modernism, and through his self-nomination as the arbiter of legitimate musical revolution more broadly. Furthermore, just as there is a politics that shapes aesthetics, so too is there an aesthetic dimension to politics. As a critical theorist, David Panagia notes, quote, our understandings of political life are informed by our aesthetic sensibilities. And this, it should be noted, characterizes all of political life, not just the fascism that Walter Benjamin accused of having aestheticized politics, which is arguably better understood as having reduced or subordinated politics to aesthetics. Viewed from this angle, the oppositions that I've highlighted in Boulez's references to Lenin can all be understood as variants of classic aesthetic categories, organization staying in for order or form, professionalism staying in for craftsmanship, in totality's relation to the local, staying in for the traditional part-whole dialectic. Thus, just as Boulez-Leninism isn't strictly a matter of politics, neither is it simply a calculated act of positioning within a competitive field of symbolic production and valorization. It is, in addition, I'd argue, driven by a kind of pre-rational aesthetic sensibility, an elective affinity that Boulez had towards certain kinds of aesthetic and also socio-political orderings, and concomitantly a disaffiliation he had with alternative orderings. Indeed, this aesthetic sensibility is perhaps most clearly expressed in negative terms in the visceral disdain he voices for the small anarchism of post-68 contemporary music. Thus, in a 1972 interview with Sylvie de Nussac, he responds to a question about the state of the field thus. Quote, une diarrhée de médiocrité. on assiste à un vagabondage théorique, à une disparition de toute pensée cohérente. This depiction of the body politic, and by extension the body musicale, registers an almost physical revulsion, one that operates at the level of affect and aesthetics. Notably, it's just after this unsparing assessment of the state of contemporary music that Boulez strikes a more optimistic note. Quote, c'est pourquoi le projet d'un centre de recherche à Beaubourg m'intéresse énormément. It was around the same time that his plans for what would become IRCOM were beginning to take shape that another point of reference, the Bauhaus, starts to assume greater prominence in his public commentary. One might even be tempted to say that it assumes some of the functions as increasingly infrequent allusions to Lenin and Leninism had hitherto performed. There is, of course, the Bauhaus's utopianism, and relatedly its vague association in the public consciousness with the left, despite the not always successful efforts of its leadership to keep the Institute at arm's length from the hurly-burly of Weimar politics. Just as important is the way the historical model of the Bauhaus also serves as a master signifier that binds together many of the oppositions structuring Boulez's political imaginary. This is most evident in the clear precedent that the Bauhaus provided for IRCOM at an organizational level. The same is true of its global approach to design in the built environment, which in turn required the collaboration of experts, artists, painters, craftsmen, designers, and architects, among others. By means of this analogy with the Bauhaus, politico-aesthetic ideals of organization, professionalism, and systematicity could be transmitted to IRCOM, with its proposed collaboration of musicians and scientists seen as providing a solution to some of the intractable problems that Boulez diagnosed in contemporary musical life. Yet as these ideals became disarticulated from Leninism and rearticulated to the figure of the Bauhaus, there's a way in which this new context, and indeed the subsequent development of IRCOM, brought to light a contradiction that lurked just beneath the surface of Boulez's repeated appeals to Leninism, for that matter, in the conception of political, institutional, and musical transformation that it represented. It's here that I wish to end my paper today, namely with the tension that emerges between Boulez's desire for a comprehensive and systemic approach to institutional change and his firm commitment to professionalism, defined as it was by a strict delineation of discrete areas of competence. Paradoxically, the global perspective that Boulez argued for was therefore a highly specific and localized one, largely restricted to a particular domain, that of music. The trouble, however, is that many of the ills that Boulez diagnosed in the contemporary musical field weren't exclusively musical, having to do rather with the field's relation to the broader social, economic, and technological systems in which contemporary music was embedded. Consider the cost disease diagnosed by William Baumol, a dynamic at the heart of the economic and sociological problems that Boulez observed within modern concert life. According to Baumol, the precarity of orchestras and other performing arts ensembles is rooted in their relatively stagnant levels of productivity compared to more dynamic sectors of developed economies. It's perhaps no coincidence that these dynamics were acutely felt by Boulez and others in the decades leading up to IRCOM's founding, given that productivity rates in the global economy, and in France more specifically, were skyrocketing during Les Trente Glorieuses. Driven by gains in industry and agriculture, this rapid increase in productivity levels presumably made the lagging productivity of music and the other performing arts all the more perceptible. At the same time, however, the surpluses generated through such productivity gains were the condition of possibility for the expansion of the French welfare state, providing the material basis for state support of new music and the creation of an institution like IRCOM in the first place. To meaningfully address these and other forces structuring musical life would, of course, require a change in the broader political economy, which, to paraphrase Boulez, would require one to undertake a global analysis, comme Lénine, which raises a question. Not whether Boulez's references to Lenin were a provocation, one that responded to the prevailing political sensibilities of the post-68 cultural field, but rather, if I may be permitted to end with a provocation of my own, whether Boulez was Leninist enough. Thank you.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr. Les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.